You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Missed that.
It is.
You are unmuted.
But now open, you may be seated.
All right, so I was told, counsel, Mr. Lessie, you wanted to see me?
Yes, please, Your Honor.
Okay. Did you want to come to sidebar?
Start at sidebar and then
sure.
We'll go from there if we could.
Okay.
You are unmuted.
All right. I was told counsel wanted to see me at sidebar again.
But now we may be seated.
Oh, great. Great.
You solemnly swear the evidence of the court in case now and hearing should be truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes, sir. You're welcome. Good morning, Your
Honor. Good morning, sir. So we're going to have a short voir dire.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so Mr. Lessie.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Morning, Dr. Welcher.
Good morning.
If you look at any documents in answering my question, I appreciate you letting me know that, okay?
Okay.
Do you have any documents open in front of you at this moment?
I do. I have a binder.
Your Honor, I would ask until the question comes up.
Can you do without it, sir, for a few minutes?
Depending on the question, sure.
Okay. So just let us know if you need to look at it. Don't look at it without
permission,
please. All right. Go ahead, Mr. Lessie.
Thank you, Your Honor. Dr. Welcher, you have changed your PowerPoint presentation in the last few days in this case, correct?
I deleted a slide and removed a couple words.
Right, but you've changed your PowerPoint presentation, correct?
Correct, I deleted a slide and deleted a couple words.
Who have you spoken to at the Commonwealth in the last 2 weeks? Anybody associated with the Commonwealth, who have you spoken to?
In the last 2 weeks, Mr. Brannon, Mr. Lally, Lieutenant Tully.
Anyone else?
I think Mary Ellen Gray.
Anyone else?
The tech person, Cindy, this morning.
And with regard to those conversations, what prompted those conversations? Who initiated them?
I was originally told I was going to have to be out here last Monday, so there was a whole flurry of conversations around that. I was initially told I may have to give all my rebuttal testimony on a whole huge data set I'd received.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, sir. My question was simply because we have a limited amount of time. Who initiated the conversations?
Oh, there were multiple conversations.
How many?
I have no
idea. More than 10?
I'm sorry?
More than 10?
Probably not.
All right, what did you discuss with you understand it's no longer Detective Lieutenant Tully. It's, as I understand, it's Lieutenant Tully. Did you have conversations, you said you had conversations with him, correct?
Correct.
When was the first conversation, how many, and what are the nature of those conversations?
Are you limiting it to the last 10 days or in total in my life?
Within the last 2 weeks.
Last 2 weeks. I believe it was when I got here on Saturday night, I informed them I'd landed, and then Sunday morning, he gave me a ride over to the district attorney's office.
And what did you discuss from when you, did you have any discussions with Lieutenant Tully before Saturday, within the last 2 weeks?
Not to my knowledge.
What did you discuss with Lieutenant Tully? Topics.
Give me a time frame.
I keep saying the last 2 weeks. That's the time frame I'm looking at.
All the conversations I had with him?
Yes.
Can you have somebody pick me up at the hotel?
I'm talking substantive, sir, about your outline, your PowerPoint presentation. Topics of what discussions about the topics in your PowerPoint presentation?
I had no discussions with him about the topics in my PowerPoint presentation.
Who did you have discussions with from the Commonwealth about the topics in your PowerPoint presentation?
Mr. Brannon and Mr. Lally.
Describe those conversations and how many you had, including the first one that you had.
Well, I originally submitted my presentation with my original report way back, I believe, in January.
Right. I'm asking for conversations within the last 2 weeks.
Okay, your question wasn't clear. Then on Sunday, we just went through top to bottom through my presentation. Mr. Brannon wanted to make sure he understood everything in it. And then I met with Mr. Brannon again on Sunday. We ran through it briefly again. And then that was largely it.
Who suggested the changes to your presentation?
Mr. Brannon.
Mr. Brannon suggested the changes that you make.
He indicated some of the things, for example, the slide I deleted referenced testimony that I was not allowed to include on a slide.
Were there any discussions with anybody from the prosecution team about the changes with regard to the what I would call the Dighton route, the Dighton distance, and the total mileage? Do you know what slide I'm referring to, sir?
I do, yes.
Who initiated the discussion on the changes to that slide?
So that slide was changed, I don't know, probably 8 or 10 days ago.
Oh, it was changed 8 or 10 days ago.
Correct.
Were there any changes made from 8 or 10 days ago to what's now in your presentation?
Not beyond what we talked
about. Oh, okay. So 10 days ago, those changes were made.
8 to 10 days ago. I could actually probably figure out exactly when, if you like.
Now my next questions go to Mr. Burgess. Mr. Burgess is a colleague of yours at Aperture, correct?
Correct.
Are you aware of issues relating to the accuracy or inaccuracy of his CV?
Unfortunately, I've been bombarded with emails that have referenced that. I've seen it, I have not read them.
You've been bombarded with them, but you have, and you say unfortunately, but you have not read any of them? None?
Maybe one or two lines. For example, they come in, they're looking like legitimate business emails, and then I pull it up as a business email. I'm like, okay, I'm not supposed to do this. Court said I can't look at this.
Now, I want to go back to your slide presentation. I understand that you intend, subject to our objections at the court's ruling, you intend to present testimony with regard to your PowerPoint where you are going to elaborate on your 1231.38 to 1231.43, trigger 1162.2, and you're going to add to what has been in your presentation a verbal discussion with regard to Mr. Burgess's change that he made in his May 8th report with regard to the variance time window. Do I have that correct?
No, you don't. It's not based upon a verbal discussion. It's based upon his report.
Okay, so you're going to make, you propose, what you're intending to do is you want to add the change from Mr. Burgess's May 8th report to what you're going to testify to on your PowerPoint. Do I have that correct?
That is correct.
And the only reason you're going to testify with regard to altering the 1231.38 to 1231.43 window is because of what Mr. Burgess has done on May 8th. Is that correct?
It's better data, so I'm altering it and correcting it with better data that I've received from Mr. Burgess.
Right, but my point is, if it weren't for Mr. Burgess's change, you wouldn't be making any changes in your testimony, correct? It's only because of what Mr. Burgess did on May 8th. Is that correct?
Only from his report, correct.
Correct. So, and you understand, sir, that that change has significant effects on the very issues in this case with regard to the timeline and the collision you allege occurred, and comparing it to human volitional conduct of Mr. O'Keefe with regard to his manipulation of the phone. You understand the consequences of that change, do you, sir?
I do. I would disagree with your assertion that this is consequential. Again, my original data, which is in my PowerPoint and has not changed, that data is still there. The timing was extremely close within the error of the measurements, which Mr. Burgess ultimately showed in his subsequent report that that was within the variance associated with those timing devices.
I understand, but my point, sir, and I want to understand if I have it correct, is that is going to move the time that you assert the 1162-2 trigger occurred, correct?
Correct.
And you would agree that's a substantial change given the issues in this case when seconds matter? Or do you think it's an insignificant change?
I wouldn't say it's insignificant. Again, I haven't modified my PowerPoint at all. I was happy with the data I had and satisfied with the data I had. Again, once presented as engineer Wood with better data, we use better data. It brings it closer in time to Ian Whiffen's last contact point data. But even if we don't have that, given what I knew about the variance in the cell phones, my time was still within that window anyway.
Sir, you've just answered my question, which is you agree that it affects the timeline in the activity of Mr. Whiffen's report. You said brings it closer. Did I have your words correctly?
Correct. What I was concerned about was your word about significant change. It brings it closer. It doesn't necessarily bring it significantly closer. My original timeline was very close, within the range of the accuracy of that, those types of cell phones, infotainment system data. So even if I didn't have Mr. Burgess's subsequent report, the data is still within that time window.
Sir, isn't it a fact that with the variance of Mr. Burgess that you're now going to, you want to testify to, that there is a change? Because your 1162-2 trigger, 1231-38 to 1231-43, you know that there's a device lock event on the phone of Mr. O'Keefe after that time period. You understand that, correct?
So again, there's a window of plus minus on that. Technically, those timestamps on that are, as you indicated, again, there's literally, I wrote that on my slide. It includes my slide where I have that exact comment.
But my question, sir, is the change means now that with the Mr. Burgess variance moving, you now have part of the moving range that occurs after the device lock, whereas before your change, the device lock occurred after every bit of your range of 1162.2. I have that correct, don't I, sir?
You do.
Okay.
Okay,
Your
so
Honor,
that's it.
That's all I needed. Thank you.
All right, so we're going to bring the jury in. Are they outside the door? Awesome. You may as well stay right there.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll see you at sidebar. No, they can come in. So we took up a lot of your time this morning. I think the coffee and donuts and muffins was probably a hint that we were taking longer than what we ordinarily would do. I do appreciate your patience. So I have to ask you those questions. Were you all able to follow the instructions and refrain from
discussing this case with anyone since we met last week?
Yes.
Everyone said yes or nodded affirmatively. Were you also able to follow the instructions and refrain from doing any independent research or investigation into this case?
Yes.
Everyone said yes or nodded affirmatively. Did anyone happen to see, hear, or read anything about this case since we left here last week?
No.
Thank you. With that, Mr. Brennan?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sir, can I just stand and raise your right hand?
Yes, sir.
You solemnly swear the honest truth of the court and jury of the case now here is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sir, may I refer to my resume?
Yes, sir.
May I refer to my resume?
All right, Mr. Brennan.
Thank you.
Whenever you're ready.
Good morning, sir.
Morning, Mr. Brennan.
Could you please introduce yourself to the jury and spell your first and last name for the court reporter who's next to you?
Absolutely. My name is Judson Welcher. My first name is J-U-D-S-O-N. Last name is Welcher, W-E-L-C-H-E-R.
Sir, what do you do for a profession?
I'm an accident reconstructionist and biomechanical engineer.
I'd like you to explain to us a little bit about what an accident reconstructionist does.
Sure. You can think of accident reconstruction and things such as this as the physics and engineering that happens in car crashes. So accident reconstruction tends to deal with everything that happens to the car and outside the car, skid marks, vehicle damage, the electronic recording systems in the vehicle, things that have to do with the motion forces and how the physics of everything occurred and how that affected the motion of the vehicles.
You said that you were an accident reconstructionist, but also a biomechanical engineer. How is your work as a biomechanical engineer different than an accident reconstructionist?
So simply, you can think of biomechanics as similar, but to everything inside the car. So biomechanics is looking at how the effects of physical forces are applied to the human anatomy. When I'm trying to explain to somebody what I do, I say, hey, it's like a civil engineer who's designing a bridge. So many trucks and cars on the bridge, are that gonna cause the beams in the bridge to fail? Is that gonna cause the cables to fail? So a human body is governed by the same laws of physics, just like the bridge. Obviously, it's made of a lot of different materials, but in a human body, my beams are bones. My cables are the muscles and ligaments. Different material properties, but everything's governed by the laws of physics and principles of engineering. So I'm looking at how physical forces, the outside of the car, for when people are inside the car, seat belts, airbags. The first seat belt was patented by an engineer. It's engineers who quantify the force of the crash and what kind of injury damage there is to the body. So it is force that causes damage like a fracture. And so we're looking at how the physical forces are applied to the body and what that means in terms of what happens to the body.
Dr. Welcher, I want to ask you a little bit about how you became a biomechanical engineer and an accident reconstructionist. Can you tell us?
Sure. So when I was getting ready to go to college, my father, who was a physician, said, whatever you do, do not go to medical school. Because I was getting ready to go to medical school. So this was 39 years ago, I believe. 39 years ago. He said, it's just not worth it. So I said, okay. So then I entered into the mechanical engineering. I grew up riding motorcycles, taking things apart, frequently pissing my parents off when I couldn't put it back together. But I liked taking things apart and figuring out how things worked. So I went to university and got my undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering. From there, I happened to be at a Thursday meeting of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. A group came in from a company that did this type of work, and they showed some examples of how you apply engineering concepts that you learn in mechanical engineering to the human body. And so I was like, man, that's a great job. That's the perfect mix of engineering that I have and my desire, you know, to learn the medical side of things as well without becoming a doctor. So I talked to them. I actually applied to the company and was ultimately hired as a biomechanical engineer.
How long did you continue as a biomechanical engineer until you went back to school?
So I actually, very quickly after I started the job, I took a human anatomy class at a community college. I quickly realized that wasn't enough. And so in around 1993, I went to the USC Medical School and enrolled through what's called concurrent enrollment, which means you can take the class, but you're not actually in medical school. It's a medical school class. But I took gross human anatomy. So it was me and 160 or so other doctors. I took the same human anatomy that first year medical students at USC took. So it began in 1993.
Did you continue to work as you pursued your higher education?
I ultimately started my own company, continued to work, continued to do research, had a wonderful opportunity to have two beautiful children, and continue to this day.
Tell us a little bit about the company you started and when.
Sure. So in about October of 1994, I started my own company. Me and the guy who was my immediate supervisor said, hey, we can do this better. We can do more research, more testing. And so we started our own company.
What kind of company was it?
It was an action reconstruction and biomechanical engineering company. We also early on did a bunch of testing and design work for amusement park rides. The same concepts for car crashes applies to roller coasters, basically anything. So we worked and had some contracts on improving ride safety. And I was also on the ASTM committee that looked at amusement park ride designs.
Did that company grow from two people?
Correct. We took it from two to about 25 people. And then we ultimately sold it in right around January 1st of 2022.
Before 2022, did you obtain a master's degree?
I did.
And what was that in and where was that from?
So again, I was working full time. Actually, while I was doing my master's degree, I was also teaching classes at Texas A&M through their law enforcement training division. So it was extension classes. But I ultimately completed my master's thesis in December of 2001. That was from USC, University of Southern California, and I received my master's degree in biomedical engineering. I wrote my thesis. It was basically on automotive seat design, but it was titled Whiplash-Associated Disorders, Related Anatomy, Biomechanics of Injury, and the Relationship Between Injury Potential and Automotive Seat Design.
Excuse me, Your Honor, if I may, pardon the interruption. If Dr. Welcher reads from his report, which I think he just did, can we know when he's doing
that? Sure. Dr. Welcher asked me if he could refer to his resume, and I said yes. So if you read, just let us know.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
And it's my resume, not my report.
Your resume, did I say
report? No, you did. He said report.
Yeah, no, it's his resume.
You share with us that your company continued to grow until you ultimately sold it in 2022. During that time, did you continue to pursue higher education after you obtained your master's degree?
I did. So again, ever since 1993, I've been slowly pursuing higher education, both obtaining my master's degree as well as my PhD. During that time frame, I also published 20 peer-reviewed scientific publications. I taught for 5 years at Texas A&M and served as a peer reviewer for both the Society of Automotive Engineers and for a short period on the Archives of Physical Medicine. So I was working and running a company with my co-creator, as well as teaching, conducting research, publishing, also while going to school part-time.
Take us to 2011. Were you still pursuing education at the University of Southern California?
I was.
And what occurred? What did you achieve in 2011?
So in August of 2011, I finally obtained my PhD in biomedical engineering. I wrote my dissertation, reading from my resume, titled Development, Validation, and Testing of a New Sensor Array for Intra-Articular Pressure Measurement, In Vitro Human Lumbar Spine Intra-Articular Facet Testing, which is a lot of big words to say. I was testing cadaver spines, looking at the loads inside the spines associated with various motions of the spine.
Did you achieve your PhD in biomechanical engineering?
It's actually in biomedical engineering. Biomechanics is within the field of biomedical engineering.
So you have a PhD in biomedical engineering?
Correct.
You mentioned that you've published many articles. Have there been articles that you've published that are relevant to some of the subjects that you're going to talk about during your testimony?
I mean, I have a number of, peer-reviewed scientific publications. Peer review just means you submit it to a journal and they have other people review it, give you comments, your peers in the field. I do believe there are a number of them that could certainly be relevant to both the physics and, for example, pedestrian injuries.
If I could mention a few. You wrote an article on sideswipe collision dynamics. What's sideswipe collision dynamics?
So I was actually an invited speaker at the World Congress, or sorry, not the World Congress, the World Reconstruction Expedition. They asked me to give a presentation on the theory, science, and mathematics behind sideswipe or side impact collisions. That would include side collisions, glancing collisions, shallow angle impacts, such as like a corner of a bumper goes into the side of a car, any kind of glancing or clipping type impact.
Similarly, in many of the articles that you wrote, is one of them about methods for quantifying the impact severity of low speed side impacts at varying angles?
It is.
Tell us a little bit what that.
So that was a Society of Automotive Engineers paper, again, another peer-reviewed paper that we worked on. It was kind of an extension or continuation of all that research, where we just looked at the physics and the mathematics, basically the reconstruction of glancing or sideswipe type impacts.
Similarly, methods for quantifying the impact severity of low-speed side impacts at varying angles. Is that similar to the other papers, or was that different?
Yeah, I thought that was the same one.
If I can continue, another article or publication that you wrote, Occupant Kinematics and Loading in Low-Speed Lateral Impacts. What does that mean?
So, in the course of my career, I've done probably 12 to maybe 1,300 actual crash tests. I've crashed everything from skateboards, mopeds, up to trains, motorhomes, and ambulances. I've conducted relatives, this case, probably, or been involved with 50 to maybe 70 pedestrian impact tests. So the low speed side impact one is we actually put human volunteers in side impact collisions. And what we did is we had accelerometers, which are things that measure acceleration. If you had physics or memory, Newton told us force equals mass times acceleration. So knowing the acceleration of something, you can get an idea of how much force is applied to it. So we have various sensors on the body. We have various sensors on the car for the reconstruction aspects of it. So that study was the biomechanics portion. And the first paper you read about the reconstruction was the reconstruction portion. So the first paper you discussed was everything outside the car. Then we looked at how the forces applied to those impacts to people inside the car.
Have you had a lot of publications and studies about the force applied to people outside of a car?
I don't know if I'd say a lot, but I was an invited lecturer to the Accident Reconstruction and Collision Safety Institute conference, where I specifically gave a paper and a series, or basically a lecture, on what's called pedestrian impact biomechanics, which was exactly as the name implies, what happens to pedestrians when they're impacted predominantly by cars and vehicles.
How much of your work involves pedestrian impacts?
Probably maybe 10%. 5 to 10%. Most of it's car to cars.
Biomechanics of low speed impacts. Is that another paper that you wrote?
That is a paper I wrote.
I don't want to read all of your papers and all of your publications, but on a different topic, did you write a paper on the study of the measurement of Generation 2 Toyota event data recorders in low speed side impacts?
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about what measurement of event data means?
So, Toyotas, newer Toyotas particularly, have two types of electronic equipment on board that can record crashes. There is what's referred to as an event data recorder, or EDR. It's somewhat commonly referred to as a black box. That's not exactly right, but it's close. And then there's a secondary system, which is really more closely tied to maintenance. That's called Techstream, but it will pick up data that you can frequently relate back to various events. So that particular paper was looking at the event data recorder data in Toyotas.
We'll get more into that subject later, but is it event data recorders a subject that you're well-schooled at?
Yes.
In addition to the papers that you've written, have you continued through the years and after becoming a PhD, your research in this area, in these areas?
Correct. For example, every year we're part of a conference called SATI, which is our company, largely led by an engineer, Christopher Furbish, that we work with, has spearheaded us going out and conducting crash tests for that conference for 10 years. We did a lot of the instrumentation and crash testing at the Accident Reconstruction and Collision Safety Institute conference. And then for a number of years, I actually, the company actually went down and did crash testing for what's referred to as the Spine Research Institute down in San Diego. So we've been hired by various professional organizations. We came out here once, the Massachusetts Association of Accident Reconstructionists, I think I'm messing the name up, had a conference. We came out here and conducted crash tests for training other experts out here. We did all the instrumentation, the biomechanics of that crash testing.
In your research and testing, you have pages with dates of the different researches and testing you've done. There's over a dozen of the research and testing items and articles that deal with pedestrians. Is that a common topic in your research and testing?
Yes. So again, you know, frequently at the conference, we're doing pedestrian tests. The last Accident Reconstruction Collision Safety Institute conference, there was a series of pedestrian crash tests run there. SATI 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, some pedestrian crash tests that were done there as well. So there are a number of instances on my resume where I have both attended class, and then I mentioned the one time where I gave an hour and a half long lecture on pedestrian injuries.
After you became a PhD or a doctor, do you continue your education and research?
Correct. I've always continued my education and research up until, you know, I just got back from the event data or Accident Reconstruction Collision Safety Institute EDR conference, or the Event Data Recorder Summit. My company, through my relationship with the founder of that summit, was a sponsor. So Aperture was actually a sponsor of that conference. We actually sponsored it the previous year as well. And also as part of that, I assisted one of the researchers in conducting, it's called front camera module testing for pedestrian impacts on Chrysler vehicles. General Motors vehicles.
As a biomedical engineer, are there any groups, organizations, or certifications that are important?
I think ACTAR is important. So ACTAR is an acronym. It's ACTAR, and that's short for the Accreditation Commission for Traffic Accident Reconstructionists. And so it's a bunch of professional groups, originally from some concerns, I believe, from the Department of Transportation, got together and set standards for reconstructionists. Again, these are kind of minimum standards. You have to show, you send in your resume, you talk to them about your research, and then if you're deemed qualified, you sit for an examination that tests your skills, day-long test, theory, a practical portion, and then every 5 years, you have to have 60 continuing education units to become reaccredited. I've been an accredited accident reconstructionist since February of 1995, and my accreditation is current and active up through today.
So you've been accredited for 30 years?
Yeah, correct.
I don't want to trick you on the math.
No, I never thought about it, but yeah, I guess it has been 30 years.
Have you testified in court before?
I have.
Have you testified in state courts?
I have.
Have you testified in federal court?
I have, matter of fact, in Boston.
Have you ever testified in civil cases?
Yes, I have.
Have you testified being called by the plaintiff?
I have.
Have you ever testified being called by a defendant in a civil case?
Yes.
Have you testified in criminal cases?
I have.
Have you ever been called by the state or the government?
Yes.
Have you ever been called by a defendant?
Correct, public defender's office.
In any of the cases, whether it's civil, criminal, plaintiff, defendant, government defendant, does that in any way change your analysis about data, regardless of who or where you testify?
No. I take my job as to be a critical analysis of the data. So I wanted to look at the data as objectively as possible and form conclusions based upon the data, trying to remove wherever possible speculation, try to remove wherever possible reference to testimony. Now, sometimes testimony is the only thing we have, and so we need to rely on it for bits and pieces. But generally, my job is to try and look at data and see what the data shows. I have no dog in this fight. I don't, quite frankly, care. What I'm doing is trying to do a good engineering job, which is looking at the data and drawing sound principles and sound conclusions from the data.
Presently, you said you had a company and you sold it. Where do you work?
It's a company called Aperture. I guess we were acquired or merged into it, technically.
How many offices do you know if Aperture has?
Oh, God, I should know that. I mean, we have them in Massachusetts. We have them in, I think there's three or four in Texas. There's, I think, four or five in California. So I want to say there's at least, I don't know, 13 to 15.
Do you work at a particular location?
I do.
Where do you work?
Long Beach, California.
Do you work with other people? Do you have a team?
I do.
How many people are on your team?
Five.
And what's the team comprised of? Is everybody a PhD in engineering?
One individual is a PhD in engineering, Dr. Umali. And then I have three other engineers and one case reader. I guess it's six people. I have a case manager as well.
Is there any, do you work interchangeably at the different branches around the country, or do you have your own team in California that you work with?
99% of the time, it's my own team. Occasionally, we'll get a case from another office. I've worked on a couple cases out of the Texas office,
okay,
and maybe a couple out of the Nevada office.
Were you asked to look at any data or information relative to this case?
Yes.
In looking at data and information, do you try to look at a narrow or broad range of information?
So I definitely cast a very broad range. We try and get as much information as possible. And then you know, weed it down to what is important, weed it down to what is consistent with the data. So start off very big and then get down to sort of the meat and potatoes of it, the important information.
Do you necessarily rely on everything you look at?
No, I certainly consider everything I look at, but I frequently don't rely on everything because sometimes it's not reliable.
I see.
Or it's irrelevant.
In this case, can you share with us materials generally that you looked at in your review?
Sure. Your Honor, may I read from my report?
Yes.
Thank you. So, Mr. Reporter, I apologize. It's a lengthy list.
Slow.
So I have police reports, including the Canton PD incident report, and I have eight other reports, also the 34 Fairview Road Rams final report or cars report. I have the Ring video from Mr. O'Keefe's residence. I believe that's One Meadows. I have the cruiser cameras, which are the police vehicles, onboard cameras, both front and rear cameras from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I believe 10 different videos. I have photos and videos of the scene from a sergeant. I have photos of the vehicles, 140 photographs of the vehicles lined up together. I have 25 additional photographs of the scene, 18 separate photographs of the scene, 2 photographs of the scene, 1 group of 92 of the scene, 1 group of 50 of the scene, another video showing the cars lined up bumper to bumper, 4 videos of the scene. I have a video showing Miss Reed's vehicle being pulled into the Sallyport at the Canton Police Department. I have a 360 diagram, surveillance video files from McCarthy's, surveillance video files from Waterfall Bar, Canton Police Report, Sallyport videos from Dighton. I have the Lexus Connect Verizon records. I have the alarm.com videos. I have a video of the tow truck arriving at the Canton Police Department. One titled Native Location, John O'Keefe's phone. Past witness statements. The report of examination from the coroner. Jennifer McCabe's Cellbrite data. Something called Lexus infotainment. Different past summary testimony of numerous witnesses. I have earlier summary testimony of numerous witnesses. The Boston interview, Boston Magazine interview with Miss Reed, a Dateline interview with Miss Reed, a 2020 interview with Miss Reed, lab reports from Bode, the Crime Scene Response Unit, Crime Scene Response Unit Boston, Crime Scene Service Section Maynard, Crime Scene Service Section Southeast, the Criminalist File Folder, Trace File Folder, UC Davis Veterinary Report. I have Verizon records, GPS location records, John O'Keefe GPS points, Axiom cache location, weather reports, medical records, including the Canton Fire Department run report for both Mr. O'Keefe and Ms. Reed, medical records for both Mr. O'Keefe and Ms. Reed from Good Samaritan. I have 2 retrograde extrapolation reports, one, and a serum plasma conversion report relative to Ms. Reed. I have the neuropathology report. I have the Orange County Medical Examiner's report, the diagrams, the postmortem toxicology report, and a second autopsy report, more pages.
In addition to the information that you reviewed, did you on your own go out and obtain information that you thought might be helpful for your review?
I did. So first what happened is I asked for all the information on the case. So I received some information, and then what we do is we start doing our homework. So we start doing the groundwork. So once I received some of the information, what I did was, modern cars have what's called a VIN number or vehicle identification number. It's a unique 17-digit number. So what we'll do is we'll decode that VIN number, and that gives us information about the vehicles. So I did that for Ms. Reed's 2021 Lexus, as well as Mr. O'Keefe's 2019 Chevy Traverse. So ran the VIN numbers. Use the VIN numbers, it tells us year, make, model, safety equipment, things like that. I then got dimensional data from a program called Expert Autostats, and then I have complete parts diagrams for the vehicles. So I have literally bumper-to-bumper parts diagrams from something called the Mitchell Collision Estimating Guide, and what that is shows parts, involved in the vehicle. So for example, in Ms. Reed's vehicle, even though I have bumper-to-bumper, I certainly have all the parts around the rear bumper and taillight of her vehicle. And then, of course, I started additional work on top of that.
After you began your study, sir, did you have an opportunity to personally look at items that were involved in this case?
Yes, I did.
And what did that include?
That included looking at Ms. Reed's vehicle, looking at Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle, going to the scene of the incident. I ultimately purchased a 2021 LX570, the exact year, make and model of Ms. Reed's vehicle, and conducted testing with that vehicle, as well as doing a whole bunch of research and compiling data for my report and slides.
You mentioned slides. When you went through your investigation, analysis, and ultimately led to whatever conclusions you have, did you create a PowerPoint presentation that could assist you?
I did. I provided a PowerPoint presentation on January 30th.
Okay. May I approach, Your Honor?
Yes. Yes.
Sir, I'm handing you a binder. Would you kindly take a look at it?
Okay.
Sir, does that appear to be a copy of the PowerPoint presentation that you prepared for us today?
It appeared, right? 141 pages, didn't look at every page, but it looks right.
Okay. You are asked to mark this for identification.
Okay.
Is it MMM for identification?
With the court's permission, I'd like to have Dr. Welcher use his PowerPoint presentation to walk us through some of the information he'd like to share today.
Okay. No objection, Mr. Lesson, right?
No objection, Your Honor. Thank you.
Your Honor, I'm looking at a paper version in front of me.
Okay. Is the paper version the same as what we're going to see up here?
It is.
Okay, then that's fine.
Thank you. And Dr. Welcher is going to manage the PowerPoint presentation. Okay. Sir, you mentioned that you wanted to look at the area and look at the scene. Your office is in California?
It is.
Why was it important to come all the way out to this area to see the scene firsthand?
Hold on a second.
I'll let you set up before I start asking you more questions.
Oh, we went through this, had it working perfectly. Here we go.
Okay.
So that's me. No, that's my first slide.
I have a couple questions for you, Dr. Welcher.
Please.
The first is, your office is in California?
Oh, yes, sir.
Why was it important to come all the way out here and view the scene firsthand?
Again, you want to have as much information as possible. So I wanted to, you know, physically look at all the things so I can actually see with my own hands, my own eyes, lay hands upon it, look at it as best I can. You try and inspect and look at as many things as you possibly can. Sometimes they don't exist anymore, sometimes they're gone, and you have to make a best approximation if you can't do that. In this case, I was able to look at the scene and both vehicles.
Was that an important part of your study, Doctor?
I think so. Again, it's always good if you're gonna talk about what happened to the cars or what happened to the people to look at what happened to the cars, meaning to actually look at the cars, not just look at photographs when possible. So I have physically looked at the cars. For example, on the Lexus, I climbed in it, over it, underneath it. I downloaded data from it. I did a whole bunch of things looking at Ms. Reed's Lexus to assist in my analysis to try and add some further objective data to what we're doing here. So same thing with Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle. Looked at the rear bumper. Took some pieces off the rear bumper to see what was behind the cover, to see what kind of damage we did or didn't have. So, went to the scene, looked at the measurements of the curb, looked at where some of the lines are on the road, because you can see them in some of the photographs. Again, it's it's always good when possible to inspect everything you can inspect.
If you could now begin and tell us how you started your investigation.
Sure. So on September 23rd, I had an opportunity to come out. Mr. Brandon, was the first time I ever met you on that day, I believe. And I had received material before that. And what you see here is, this is my inspection of Ms. Reed's vehicle. In the upper left photograph, you'll see, oh, this doesn't work very well. Upper left photograph, that's Ms. Reed's vehicle, that's Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle, the Chevy Traverse, and then what you see here is a laser scanner. You can see it on the ground here. Laser scanner is creating a 3D model of the vehicles, so I use that to create a 3D model of the vehicles. You can see me in the upper right photograph. That watch is this watch right here, my Garmin watch. And what I'm doing is looking at the construction composition of that right rear corner of the bumper. I'm looking at things such as the dimensions, where various lights and components are, and how does the geometry of that bumper relate to things that would be hit when backed into.
Dr. Welcher notes this is 9/23/94. Is that an accurate date of when you came and first started looking at the vehicles in the area?
You said 24, correct?
I did.
You said 9/23/24, correct. And then on the slide, what I tried to do is underline what I'm doing. So this is inspection of the Reed Lexus. And as noted, I'm only showing you a couple. I actually took 445 photographs.
Do you remember when you began this case, the month or the date?
No, it was obviously before this. I had material before I came out to look at the vehicles.
Do you think it was months before this?
I don't think it was months, no. It was maybe a month, if not less.
So you began your work in the fall of 2024?
Correct.
And I just want to ask you about the picture in the middle. You see the right taillight housing is missing. Did you
Correct.
Understand that had been removed prior to you looking at the car?
It was, yes.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. However, some of the evidence stickers, these white stickers here, were still on the vehicle.
You did not place those. Did you place those stickers on yourself?
I did not.
They were they there when you first saw the car?
Correct. They match what I'd seen in other photos.
Okay, thank you.
So just continuing on, so what you see is, again, I mentioned looking underneath the bumper. So we wanted to see what, if anything, was damaged on the corner. So I'm putting my hand to show where the frame rail ends. This is me looking up underneath to the backside of this taillight. If you can see, this red taillight actually sticks out. And so I'm checking the front here for damage. I'm checking the back for damage.
1 second, please. Okay, doctor, when you were looking for damage on the previous slide, did you find any damage to that lower right red taillight?
No, there was no damage to the taillight.
The middle picture is from the inside, looking at the inside of that taillight. Was there any damage to the inside of that taillight?
There was not.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So again, looked at the height of it. I mentioned this lower taillight. Notice how the structure of the bumper protrudes out. You can see one of the marks, which is consistent with the contact to Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle. Here, this scratch mark, or scuff mark. Notice how close it is to this light. Again, some of the evidence, stickers. Just a better view of those than going down the side of the vehicle. So with all that information, I mentioned a laser scan. So you move this laser scanner, and each minute and 51 second scan is collecting about 50 million data points. And so you scan all the way around, and then what you do is you merge all that data together. So even though this looks like a poor photograph, what you're seeing is hundreds of millions of points. And so you literally can figure out, you know, if you wanted to know the distance from this lug nut to where the lighter is on the ashtray, you could probably do that to an accuracy of about 2 to 3 millimeters. So really, you know, taking tons and tons of data. So it knows the exact position of every one of these millions of data points, and it knows the color associated with those data points.
Why is that data imaging so important in accident reconstruction?
You want to have an accurate model of the car. So, I mean, you probably don't need literally that many points to get an accurate model, but that's just the nature of the way the science is going. Computers are getting better and faster. Scanners are getting faster. So you get an enormous amount of data when you use these scanners nowadays. So then, as indicated on the underline here, I did a CDR. That's a little different than what you heard me say before. CDR is crash data retrieval. So that's the hardware and software that you use to download or actually copy or take an image of, which means you're just taking an image off what's on the vehicle, the EDR, which is the event data recorder. So you use the crash data retrieval hardware to download the event data recorder, otherwise commonly known as a black box. So I downloaded the black box from this vehicle, and although you can hardly read it here, again, I mentioned there are two systems on this vehicle. This is the CDR system or EDR system. There's also the TechStream. The EDR system, this system is primarily to manage the safety components, protect the occupants of the Lexus. So things like fire the airbag, fire what's called a pretensioner, keep track of the severity of the crash to decide whether we need to fire the airbag. So it's not really designed for pedestrian impacts. So when we downloaded this vehicle, we got what's called a none file. A none file simply means that there's no data there. The system's working properly, we had no fault codes, but for a car hitting a pedestrian to cause a file here, this is really more designed for car-to-car impacts, something that's gonna have a significant impact on the occupant of the Lexus. And again, the Lexus is a 6,000-pound vehicle. Mr. O'Keefe's only 216 pounds. So it's not gonna register from hitting a pedestrian.
Were you surprised that there was no information about a collision in the EDR?
No, exactly what I expected. Okay, I mentioned the second system. So as underlined up here, this is the TechStream. So this is from Toyota, TechStream data. You can see the screens here. There's generally two types of files, what's called a vehicle control history and a PCS file. The PCS file is the, God, I forgot the name of it, the protection system. So I also looked at Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle. PCS is pre-collision system. Looked at Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle, same thing. Took a series of photographs, laser scanned it, looked in it, underneath it, behind it. I mentioned taking some of the bumper parts off. So I took this rear cover off here to look at the damage behind the bumper cover. Most cars have what's referred to as a face bar. That's that piece of metal that you see here. And there's a piece of energy absorber here. That's your face bar. So I'm looking to see if there's any damage to that. There was no damage to that.
Before you go forward, I want you to take a couple steps back because I want to ask you some questions to explain TechStream data. Could you go back a couple slides, please?
Sure.
Okay. You mentioned that in the EDR, which is similar to a black box, there was no information found. And then you mentioned a different system, the TechStream. Can you make it clear for us how these systems are different and where they're stored on a motor vehicle?
Sure. A lot of data is stored in a similar location. The TechStream system was originally designed, according to Toyota, for maintenance issues. It seemed to come about around the same time Toyota was having problems with sudden accelerations or allegations of sudden accelerations. So the tech stream data or vehicle control history will give you information when there's, for example, excessive acceleration or rapid shifting of the vehicles or rapid steering of the steering wheel. So the statements are that that's designed to help the maintenance people, if you come in with a problem with your vehicle, to diagnose what that problem is. It has a lot of utility in accident reconstruction, because if you jam on the brakes before a crash, frequently the tech stream data will record the crash.
You mentioned Toyota a number of times. Could you share with us the relationship between Toyota and Lexus? Yeah.
Sorry, in my mind, they're the same thing. Toyota and Lexus, obviously a little different, but Lexus is basically made by Toyota. So Toyota and Lexus has the Lexus safety system. Toyota has the Toyota safety systems, which you both read with the TechStream data.
The TechStream data, in this case, does it play an important role in your analysis?
I think so, yes.
The TechStream data, did you independently download that data yourself?
So I independently downloaded it, and then I also ran a test with Ms. Reed's vehicle, and I created a new TechStream file so that I had a stamp in the ignition cycles of what the current ignition cycle was. So I did a sudden acceleration test of the vehicle.
On the Lexus or on the Exemplar vehicle?
On her Lexus.
When you did the downloading, why did you do it yourself?
Again, you know, you, whenever possible, want to be the one that does it, make sure it's done correctly, and be able to say, hey, how do I know that's from that vehicle? Well, I know because I was the one who did it. And so if I get it from someone else, then they frequently have to bring that person into court to lay, you know, say the other ones that did it so then I can use it. So if I do it myself, it eliminates that problem, and then I have no concerns over where it's coming from. So then I know it's, hey, I did it. This is the right car. This is the right program.
You left us at slide 10 when you were inspecting Mr. O'Keefe's car?
Correct. So again, simply a blue arrow indicating that I looked down behind all this stuff, took measurements of it, and then similarly, I have a 3D point cloud of Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle. So part of the reason we're making these 3D point clouds, and we'll touch on this further, in addition to the scene, you can then basically put all these things back together in the computer. So instead of having to drive the cars to the scene, for example, or to Mr. O'Keefe's residence, you can take these computer models and additional data and put it back in a computer and reconstruct everything on the computer. So before we had the exact angle of impact, again, this is for looking at when Ms. Reed contacted Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle backing out of Mr. O'Keefe's garage at One Meadows. I lined them up just to generally show the approximate location. A couple things, you notice how, again, this lower portion of the Lexus bumper sticks out. Notice how the side of the Chevrolet slopes in as you get higher up. So this portion sticks out more than this portion. And this is where you would expect any contact damage to occur, assuming there was an impact. So again, looking at the measurements of the height of the vehicle, of course, as you indicated, Mr. Brennan, the taillight's gone. And then went to the scene. So same thing, you know, went to the scene, took, again, 297 photographs of the scene, had our people scan it to create a computer model of the scene. So, you know, literally, if you wanted to know the distance from this window to, say, some manhole cover on the road, we have the data to figure that out, you know, down to a couple millimeters.
In addition to going to the scene and doing the digital mapping, You mentioned other review of materials. Did you have an opportunity to review dash cam footage from Canton Police Department police vehicles to see the general location of where Mr. O'Keefe was when first responders were assisting him?
Objection, Your Honor.
So that's just a yes or no?
Yes.
Thank you.
So the text stream download. So this is a screenshot from the text stream download. Keep in mind, this is kind of maintenance software. So we're looking at a number of things in the maintenance software. What we see is, and this is noted in the report too, that when the vehicle gets into the Canton Police Department after this event, you can see the mileage is 12,665 miles. So that shows up in Trooper Paul's report. It shows up in the photographs. And it shows up as matching the mileage in the text stream data, both at Triggers 1164 and Triggers 1167.
I'd ask you if you can enlarge the data on the right and break down what it actually means, the different columns and the... Is it possible for you to enlarge that?
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second. From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public will be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.